How do you do? Jen and Cam feel it would be unkind to present this program without a friendly word of warning. We are about to unfold our true crime podcast, a podcast of lifelong friends who seek to examine crimes which were committed without reckoning upon God. The discussion will be frank, and the subject matter will be of a grim and violent nature. I think it will thrill you. It might even horrify you. So, if there are young children listening, or if you feel unwilling to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to... Well, we've warned you.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Cam, how are you?
I'm, you know, good. Question mark.
Yeah.
How are
Same
you?
Here.
Right?
I'm doing great. I finally finished this episode by the skin of my teeth. It's kind of a long one, and I thought I cut it down as much as possible, but I don't think I did it enough. But anyway, I think we should probably delve in so we don't, like, lose people.
I got you. Yay, I can't wait. You ready?
Let's go. I'm ready. Phyllis Steve, a New Orleans resident, was 39 years old in 1970. He was looking to invest $15,000 of inheritance his mother had left him. He was deciding on possibly opening a gift shop in the French Quarter, and he was talking to a friend one night at a bar, and his friend commented, "Well, if someone has a dollar, they will buy a drink before they buy a gift." So, then and there, Phil decided that he was going to open a bar. Not just a regular bar. He was going to open a gay bar. But just not any gay bar.
Oh.
He wanted the gay bar, unlike any of the others in New Orleans. He wanted a nice, respectful place. And not that any of the other bars in New Orleans wasn't respectful. But he didn't want any hustlers or any illicit sex in the bathroom. He wanted a nice, respectful place. He didn't want any illicit sex in the bathroom. He didn't want hustlers trying to pick up Johns. Matter of fact, no drugs were allowed. He just wanted a safe gathering place for people to meet and not have to worry about a raid. And in fact, once he opened the bar, Phil reportedly sent an open invitation to the Vice Squad to drop by at any time.
I get that. He just wanted a higher caliber, like, clientele. He wanted a nice, relaxing people to come and get together. I get it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Even though New Orleans tolerated gays, it's nothing like the accepting and welcoming New Orleans that we know of today. In 1958, the city tried to purge itself with, quote, undesirables and deviants. Even though most of that had faded away, sometimes the police would raid gay bars and arrest people inside for minor things. Sometimes gay men would even get beaten by the police. Before the Stonewall riots, many gay men could be arrested for a handshake or simply looking someone in the eye for a bit too long, or maybe even perceived too long, I should say. Because of this, very few gays and lesbians were open about their sexuality. They were out or out of the closet, as so to speak. One of those people was Buddy Rasmussen. Buddy had served as a fire chief in the Air Force, then later joined the Navy. Phil met Buddy when Buddy was tending bar at the Caverns. Phil mentioned to him that he was going to be opening a gay bar soon called The Upstairs on 604 Iberville, right on the edge of the French Quarter. Buddy quipped, "You're going to need a bartender you can trust." And right then, Buddy was hired. And he would be the head bartender and general manager of the Upstairs Lounge. The building on 604 Iberville dates back to the mid-1800s. It once was a cotton mill, but in recent times, the three-story building was the home to cocktail lounges and bars. The first floor normally had been a bar, and in fact, the Jiminy that was on the first floor when Phil opened up the Upstairs, it's still there today. Huh. And the third floor of 604 Iberville, in the 70s at least, had rooms for rent, which usually they rented to sailors. Kind of like a flop house.
Mm-hmm.
The second floor The second floor had only one entrance, and that was on Iberville Street. It had been a merchant marine bar, and then most recently a gay bar, but it needed a lot of work. When you opened up the door from the street, you couldn't actually see to the top of the bar. You just pretty much saw the stairwell. The stairs goes up, and then it would turn to your right. Mm-hmm. So all you saw was the stairwell. The stairwell, with stairs that probably were original to the building, had pipes running up and down the walls, and it was ugly and very uninviting. And since you couldn't see the bar from the street, due to the fact that, you know, the stairs had a turn, those pipes were such an eyesore, and they just had to go. So Phil and Buddy draped the fabric along the walls and the ceilings, and they covered up the place, or they covered up the pipes, and it just kind of warmed up the joint a little bit, kind of made it a little bit classier.
Yeah, that's cute. I like it.
Phil also installed a new automatic door closer to the fire door that led to the bar. That way, no one could accidentally leave the door open to let all the nice, cool air out, since they installed an air conditioning unit on the top of one of the middle windows. The bar itself was divided into three rooms, and they were divided by little archways. The first room housed the actual bar, and it was a long bar. It was about 28 feet long, and it was topped with a reddish-orange-colored laminate. And 22 red padded chrome stools pulled up right next to the bar.
1970s.
Oh, trust me, listen to this. Phil covered the walls in a red flocked wallpaper. And then added indoor-outdoor carpeting that matched the bar top.
In a bar? Lovely.
In a bar.
Woo, lovely.
The 1970s posters that were hung on the wall? The infamous naked Burt Reynolds that, remember when he was laying on the...
Playgirl. Oh my gosh.
Bearskin rug.
I so do.
Mm-hmm. Also, the other poster, Mark Spitz. Remember in his little tiny bikini bottoms?
Yep,
and then he had all those
shorts.
Medals around his neck?
Yep. I totally know
that. Threw those up on the wall. And the bar had huge windows. Like, when you go to New Orleans, you see, like, a lot of the old buildings downtown. The windows are huge.
Yeah.
They're pretty much...
Floor to ceiling.
Floor to ceiling.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when the... Most places have a balcony, but this place, for some reason, I don't know if they never built a balcony or if they got rid of the balcony.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it was. But, you know, when the windows would open, somebody could, like, totally walk out of the windows.
You know,
being drunk.
I just had this thought, too. Maybe they didn't build a balcony because it was a gay bar. And if a couple went out there and, like, kissed or held hands or whatever, and somebody saw them, that would be a huge problem for them.
Well, it was originally a cotton mill, so maybe they just didn't put one on for the cotton mill.
I got
but
you.
I don't know.
Okay.
But anyway, to keep people from falling out, before Phil even got the bar, there were bars on the windows. These aren't the kind of bars that keep, like, burglars out. These are, like, thin bars to keep people from falling out, to keep from getting in.
Right. Keep them in, not out. Gotcha.
Right. The bars were spaced far apart. And in fact, Buddy was able to squeeze through the bars at one point to clean the windows.
Oh.
He, like, fashioned a belt around the
bar. I was going to say, was he, like, a little guy? He had to be kind of little then, right?
He was kind of little.
And brave.
Yeah, I'm not really.
Because no way.
Well, he was an ex-fire chief and military man.
Yeah, he knew. Okay.
The ceilings had been lowered a bit years earlier. And, you know, it was the drop ceilings that had those acoustic tiles, right?
Yes.
Ugly. We have them in our basement, hate them, but we needed to have them when we updated the basement. But soon, Phil and Buddy just covered those with fabric also to get rid of that unsightliness. Phil and Buddy also built a platform with stairs leading up to it and placed a baby grand piano that Phil had bought. And you would think that it would make everything so crowded, but there was still plenty of room for everybody to get around.
I'm envisioning this. This is like that old.
Yeah.
So the archways.
That's what I was trying to do because this is,
The archways.
The open archways.
Yes. So that's where the beams are to hold up the ceiling, right? So then they made that.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Now, in the second room, there were tables and chairs for patrons to sit and chat. Phil and Buddy built a dance floor and they raised it off of the floor.
Ooh,
they
fancy.
Built like a, it was a platform and they raised it off the floor.
Disco.
So the people in the downstairs bar couldn't hear the people stomping around over their heads.
Huh.
And reportedly, the upstairs lounge is one of the first gay bars in the city that had been licensed to allow dancing.
Oh, fancy.
Mm-hmm. The third room had another fire door that separated it from the second room. And they went ahead and they turned the third room into a mini theater, complete with a stage. And they took those huge cable stools, you know the type, and they used them for tables for the audience to sit in.
Like the spools?
You know what I'm talking about.
The spools?
The huge cable spools.
Spools.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Yes, they took those and they used those for tables for the audience to sit at. Once they had the awning with the words upstairs lounge over the entrance door, the bar was open for business. And on Halloween 1970, they opened it up with a costume party. So after a few months, Buddy suggested having a thing called a beer bust. From 5 to 7 p.m. on Sundays, $1.50 would get you all the beer you can handle. And when you returned your mug, you got 50 cents back. Right? Could you imagine?
No, I can't. That sounds terribly delicious.
Right. Yes. And it wasn't a huge moneymaker for the bar, but it did allow for their regular customer base to grow.
Right.
Buddy hired a piano player named David Gary, or Piano Dave, to play the Baby Grand. And people would sit around the piano, singing songs, having a grand old time, mostly, of course. In the documentary I watched, one of the guys kind of laughed and said, yes, it was mostly show tunes.
Of course.
You know,
what else would it be?
Fun. I know.
Disco wasn't quite there yet.
It sounds like a fun place. Totally would have loved it there. At one of the earlier beer busts, one of the regulars, Ricky Mother Cross, and it's uncertain how he got the name Mother, he requested Piano Dave play United We Stand by the Brotherhood of Man. Do you know that one?
I don't.
United we stand, divided we fall. And if our backs should ever be against the wall, we'll be together, together, you and I. And soon that song became the anthem for the beer bust. It would be played, you know, not only at the end of the event, but sometimes multiple times throughout the evening. Like the time that we played, Push the Little Davies and Make Him Go Up. Push the Little Davies and Make Him Go Up. When we played that like 50 times.
Yeah.
Remember that? At the...
Hey. Yeah, sometimes it's important.
That was fun.
Plus, new people are coming in and going out, you know? You got to be there. You got to show them.
But anyway, the patrons would stand arm in arm, and they would sway as they sang this song. Kind of sweet. It was kind of like, it was their theme song, like I said.
This is going to make me sad, isn't it? The end.
Yes,
of this.
It is.
Yep.
This is probably the only one that gave me nightmares and wanted to change out all the windows to my house immediately.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
Okay, there were many fun events at the Upstairs Lounge. Besides celebrating Mardi Gras and Halloween, there was an Easter bonnet contest and tricycle races.
You know those bonnets had to be out of this world cool, too. Really.
Oh, I would love it. And one of the regulars, Stuart Butler, said, quote, "It was so much more than a bar in those days. It was, in fact, a social club, even though there was no fees or memberships."
It's a place to fit in. I mean, this
exactly.
is 1970, you know? Like,
and
you can't.
To be comfortable, you didn't have to worry about trying to look your best to go get picked up at a bar. You would just go and hang out with your friends who pretty much became your family.
Right. But just to, you can exhale for that time you're there.
Right.
You don't have to worry about stuff.
Exactly. Be who you are. And especially in the 70s, they could not be who they were.
That
were.
That's what I meant. Like it today, yeah. Today it's still similar, but at least it's a little bit more open. In 1970, you had a whole different persona during the daytime. So I'm sure they went there and it was like, you know, this was a whole, they could be themselves.
If
they could be whoever, you know.
Your employer had every right to fire you for loving another person of the same sex. I mean, that's so, it blows my mind. But anyway, back to the story. In the back room, or the third room, the patrons would put on plays. Now, these plays were kind of like the melodrama type, but being it was in a gay bar, everybody called them Nelly dramas, which I thought was kind of funny. Nelly is kind of a slang word for effeminate gay men.
And Nelly's also a rapper from St. Louis, Nelly and the Lunatics.
I know. The casting was purely Shakespearean. Meaning they used the men to play women's roles. And sometimes, if there was a female that would come and be in the play, they would take the men's role.
Hmm.
Phil would have bowls of popcorn on the table, and whenever a villain would appear, the crowd would throw popcorn at them. And it became so popular that the plays would be held to raise money for certain children's charities. Now, like I said earlier, for a short time, the Metropolitan Community Church was held services in the back room. And the MCC was founded in 1968 by a man named Reverend Troy Perry. And he founded it in his living room in Los Angeles. And basically, it's a Christian-based church served, or should I say serves, because it's still going strong today. They serve the gay community, and not only do they serve them in a spiritual way, they also give social guidance. And this church basically allows you to follow Christ while not hiding who you are.
So being religious and gay.
They welcome everyone into the flock.
Good.
Doesn't matter the color of your skin.
Sexual orientation.
I mean, it's exactly. I mean, it was just very accepting. Many of the gay community came to view the people of this new church as a surrogate family. It became an important part of their lives. Reverend Perry's vision spread quickly across the U.S., and by 1970, the church was in 9 states and 14 cities.
Oh, cool.
And there is one here in St. Louis. The small congregation led by Reverend Bill Larson discovered that finding a place for the MCC to hold services consistently was problematic. For the first 6 months, they held services at the St. George Episcopal Church, run by Father Bill Richardson. That was until members of Father Richardson's congregation became upset. How's this for drama? There's Karens even back then. One member said she wouldn't come back to the church unless there was an exorcism performed.
Oh, okay. So they had a little satanic stuff going on in there?
Yeah, right. No, it was the gays.
Yeah, I was being facetious. Yeah. But yeah.
I know. Somehow, Reverend Larson met with Phil, and they got his permission to use the back room of the upstairs lounge for services. Services were held at the bar for a few months, and many of the congregants stayed after services for the beer busts, including Reverend Bill Larson himself and the associate pastor, Dwayne Mitch Mitchell, and his lover, Horace Broussard. Now, let everybody know, sometimes saying the word lover makes people a little bit queasy. They don't like that. Lover was the term used back in the 1970s. They didn't really use partner. If they said boyfriend, it was more to make people laugh. Or if they said husband, it was the same thing. I mean, they just used the term lover, so I'm going to stick with that. While I'm talking about the word use, I'm going to be saying some pretty crass, very gross words later. But I only say them because that's the story. Uh-huh. I do not use them whatsoever. After a short time, members of the MCC voiced their opinions about the church being held in a gay bar. They didn't like it, so the Reverend was forced to find a new place. And eventually, he did buy a place that would serve as the MCC place of worship, and it also became a place where Bill called home. But even after the church was gone, many of the MCC congregants made it over to the upstairs for the beer bust. They enjoyed the camaraderie of the patrons, as it was a nice atmosphere with good people. Mitch and Horace actually held their Holy Union ceremony and reception at the upstairs lounge.
Aw.
They weren't the only lovers at the upstairs lounge. One night, Ricky Saleno was at the bar, and Reginald Reggie Adams sent Ricky a drink. Reggie was studying at Loyola University. Reggie was studying to be a priest, actually a Jesuit priest, and Ricky performed in drag. And I'm just going to say this real quick. In 1980, legally, Ricky changed her name to Regina, and she would later be named Southern Decadence Transgender of the Year.
You go, Regina.
Perfect. And I have been bothered about whether I should go with Ricky for the story or if I should go with Regina for the story. Out of respect for Regina, who now lives her life as a woman, I'm going to call her Regina.
I would too.
I don't know the etiquette, I guess, on this.
I think you're right. Like, Regina, that's a whole nother person, a whole nother lifetime, right? So
I've seen pictures of Regina during this time, and she may have been living as a woman then. All the literature I've read have called her by her birth name, Ricky.
Okay.
So I'm making the decision to call her Regina if that is wrong.
Unless Ricky is important in the story, meaning like the name.
They're all important in the story.
But no, but I mean, unless the name has something, I would use Regina. Because that's who they are now.
So anyway, Regina and Reggie, couples. Regina claims it was love at first sight. Now, Reggie was a black man, and most of the bars at the time didn't allow blacks inside. But the upstairs lounge was different. It didn't matter. You could go be who you wanted to be at the upstairs lounge.
Wait, no what? In the early 70s, they wouldn't let black men in the bar?
In the South? It was still pretty segregated in the South.
That is shocking to me.
It's Dang. All shocking to me. I don't understand any of it.
Okay. Wow.
So interracial relationships were looked down upon, and they just decided it was worth the risk. They loved each other. And after 3 months, Ricky decided to give up the priesthood. And actually, Reggie was one that suggested that Ricky become Regina. She had been looking for a new moniker for her show or just to actually live by. He suggested the name Regina because she was his queen, and the meaning of the name Regina was queen.
Aw, that's cute. Yeah, Regina, mm-hmm. Regal. I get it.
Mm-hmm. Or I'm sorry, within 6 months of the relationship, Regina gave Reggie her high school ring, and Reggie gave Regina a necklace with an Italian fisherman charm. Was good luck. And that was the closest thing they got to a gay wedding in the back of the days. They never exchanged vows, but this exchange was just as meaningful as any wedding or wedding ring could ever be. And like many patrons, Reggie and Regina were comfortable and they felt right at home at the upstairs lounge.
Good.
Phil had successfully managed to create a warm, welcoming place filled with fun and good conversation where everyone, politicians, doctors, lawyers, blue collar, gay, straight, black, white, everybody could be themselves without judgment of the outside world.
Which was huge in that day, seriously.
1970s. Mm-hmm. They were comfortable. Sunday, June 24th, 1973. Buddy and his lover, Adam, headed to the upstairs lounge around noon. The bar didn't open until 2 p.m., but Buddy had a lot to do before opening the doors and to get ready for the beer bus that was going to be start at 5. Phil recently had hired a man by the name of Rusty Quinton just a few weeks earlier to help on Sundays, so Phil took the night off. He and his lover went to the theater to see Damn Yankees. Buddy got together the last night's deposit, cleaned up the bar, and right before he opened for business, he poured Adam a drink. Now, this was kind of a problem in their relationship. Adam had a little drinking problem. And on Sundays, Adam would stay for the entirety of Buddy's 8-hour shift, drinking the whole time. The beer bus started promptly at 5 p.m. 22-year-old Piano Dave was taking requests at the Baby Grand, and people were singing along or dancing on the dance floor. Buddy later estimated that there was around 90 people coming in and out throughout the night. Most of the regulars were there. Horace and Mitch had arrived at the bar after dropping off Mitch's boys at the movies. Reggie and Ricky were there. They were going out to dinner with Buddy and Adam after Buddy got off work. Reverend Bill Larson was also there with some of his congregants. While Rusty was refilling pitchers of beer and Buddy was busy at the bar, a drunk, dark-headed man, later identified as Roger Nunez, started looking at the peephole in the stall, harassing people. Roger had been to the upstairs lounge a number of times, but nobody really knew his name or who he was. They just knew that they didn't like him. In the documentary, people said that they would see him and people would just kind of groan. You know those types.
Oh, yeah, I do.
You are those types.
Thanks, Jen. I hate you.
When patron Michael Scarborough used the restroom, Roger propositioned him. And like I said before, that was a huge no-no at the upstairs lounge. Michael immediately went to Buddy and told him. Buddy and Hugh Cooley, the 8 p.m. bartender and also an MCC member, pulled Roger out of the stall and was told to leave everybody alone. Roger knew he had been ratted out and beelined it over to Michael Scarborough's table, where Michael sat with his lover, Glenn Green, another MCC member. And Roger started screaming at Michael. Now, Michael was a tough guy, and he wasn't having any of it, so he stood up and punched Roger right in the jaw and knocked him to the floor. Roger yelled, "I'm going to burn you out," to Michael. Buddy and Hugh promptly went over, picked Roger up, and drug him. Nope. And dragged him. See what I did there?
I fixed that.
Buddy and Hugh probably.
Sorry. Oh, my.
At least we get our grammar fixed. Buddy and Hugh promptly went over, picked Roger off the floor, and dragged him kicking, screaming, and spitting down the stairs and out the door. There was another young man at the bar that night causing trouble, 18-year-old hustler named David. David was trying to return the beer mugs for the deposit money. When he was caught, he poured the beer all over the carpet. He was also caught soliciting some of the patrons by offering to do sexual favors in the bathroom.
Oh.
And of course, once again, big no-no. Buddy and Hugh once again threw David out the door. And David had grabbed some of the mugs. He had them in his hand and he threw them in shattered glass all over the bottom of the stairs. Now, by that time, the beer bust was over and Piano Dave had played United We Stand and the new pianist, Bud, had taken over. Bud was going to be playing for a drag show doing a charity event later that evening. The crowd dwindled down. They either headed home or basically went to a different bar, and only about 65 people remained at the bar. About 7:45, Buddy started to close his till. He would be turning the bar over to Hugh around 8 o'clock. Reggie Adams, who was going out to dinner with his lover Regina, Buddy, and Adam, he discovered that he was running low on cash. Regina gave Reggie a quick kiss and told Reggie that she would run home and get the checkbook. She'd be back in 20 minutes. On the way out the door, Regina was stopped by a woman named Jean Gosnell. She was a straight woman who always came with her best friend, Luther Boggs. Jean asked Regina if she could bring back the hat she had lent to her. She would be needing that hat in the next week. At 7:53, a woman, Catherine Kirsch, that lived across the street from the upstairs lounge, stepped out to get a pack of cigarettes. She heard someone scream fire and noticed flames on the bottom of the stairs of the upstairs lounge entrance. She ran into the bar called the Misship and told them to call the emergency fire number. Remember, 911 didn't exist back then.
Mm-hmm.
Harold Bartholomew, a lawyer, was driving by with his kids when he saw black smoke coming out from the upstairs lounge, and he stopped. He later recalled the staircase as a door to hell.
Mm-hmm.
At the bar, the buzzer that was put on the fire door for cab drivers and deliveries kept buzzing. Now, Buddy was confused because no one had called a cab, and the buzzer kept going off. So Buddy asked Luther Boggs to see who was at the door. When Luther opened the door, flames exploded 44 feet back into the bar. Luther's clothes immediately caught fire. In the book, The Upstairs Lounge Arson by Clayton Delery Edwards, explained what happened. Quote, a spring was supposed to close this fire-rated door. At the very moment it was most needed, it malfunctioned and remained open. Because the fire came from downstairs near the street entrance, and because the door to the lounge did not close properly, the stairwell acted as a massive chimney flue, funneling heat, flames, and combustible gases into the lounge.
Unreal.
Chaos. One survivor compared it to a flame shot from a flamethrower. Another described it as a big block of fire. And just like that, everything was on fire. The patrons that were singing at the piano were now screaming, trying to find a way out. One man took a chair and smashed the window leading to the fire escape. Once on the fire escape, he saw that there was no way down to the street. So he jumped over the rail. A man from the bar down the street took a pitcher of water and put out the flames on his body. Jean Gosnell and Luther Boggs followed. Luther was on fire and panicking, of course, and he started pushing Jean through the window. Well, unfortunately, he pushed her head into the window and broke out her front teeth.
Oh.
Jean climbed out the window but was afraid to jump, so she climbed to the fire escape and waited on the third floor to be rescued later by the fire department. Luther, whose body was in flames, leapt off the fire escape. His flesh was dangling from his hands, and people below tried to smother the fire with a blanket. Buddy jumped from the behind the counter. Remember, he was an Air Force fire chief in the past, and he took charge. He told his lover, Adam, to get up and follow him. Buddy walked through the bar yelling at people to follow him. As he would walk past people, he would grab them and yell at them to come with him. Buddy knew there was a fire exit in the second room, and many people did follow Buddy to this fire exit, but unfortunately, many people had been drinking for hours. They either didn't understand what was going on, what he was trying to do, or they were just too scared to even move from where they were standing. I mean, this happened in seconds.
I know. It's awful. That would be... I'm putting myself there. I can't even...
Chaos.
Yeah.
Buddy managed to get about 25 people out through the fire exit onto the roof. They then went through an apartment window and came out on the street at 606 Iberville. Most of them were not burned. Although many of the survivors were not scarred physically, they would be scarred emotionally for life. Buddy and three other men turned back and went inside the burning bar. Ricky Everett, the three men were Ricky Everett, Mitch Mitchell, and Mother Cross. Ricky made it to the doorway of the second room, but just something made him stop. And then he watched Mitch walk into the flames looking for Horace, the love of his life. Later, the burned bodies of Mitch and Horace would be found together. I can't even say this.
I know.
And I worked on this thing for fucking 3 weeks.
I'm laughing at that, not the other thing. I'm just thinking, like, and I get it. Like, you want to go back in there, but you're going to die. Like, you can't. If you make it out alive, you need to stay out. Easier said than done, I know.
Mm-hmm. Later, the burned bodies of Mitch and Horace would be found together as Mitch's sons waited for them to come pick them up from the movie theater. Mother Cross laid on his stomach and crawled on the floor, searching for his lover, Dean, or pretty much signs of anyone, really. But nothing, couldn't find anything. And the heat was intense. Buddy grabbed Mother Cross and told him that Dean had made it safely outside. Buddy then stood at the door, calling and waiting for anyone to hear him. There was never an answer. No one answered him. When the flames got too close for him to stay, to be safe, Buddy had to close the second fire door between the lounge and the theater. He got himself out of the building and stood with the crowd on the street, and it would only be a few minutes before Buddy realized that Adam was not in the crowd.
Hmm.
Those kids waited until 1 o'clock in the morning, and they finally had to call a neighbor.
Come get them.
Mm-hmm. Others still inside rushed to the huge windows trying to get out. Some windows opened, and others needed to be shattered. Ironically, the bars that were put on the windows to keep people from falling out ended up being what caused their death. The lowest horizontal bar was 14 inches from the windowsill. The vertical bars were 10 inches apart, and unless you were very thin and agile, you would not escape. Rusty Quinton was the first to squeeze through. Only 12 people escaped from squeezing through the bars. Francis Dufresne was one that got out through a window. He sustained third-degree burns over much of his body. Francis said, quote, "These days, being gay is all about muscles. Back then, if you were thin, you were in. And I was thin, thank God. I squeezed between the bars and dropped down to the sidewalk. And a few weeks later, I woke up in the hospital." Regina was just coming back from getting the checkbook, and she saw flames coming about 20 feet from the windows of the upstairs lounge. She now recalls that she just stood in the street, searching the crowd for Reggie's face, and then screaming.
I forgot she left.
Mm-hmm. In the corner window, Reverend Bill Larson tried to climb through the lowest of the horizontal bars. Suddenly, the window came crashing down on him, pinning him to the windowsill. Once he freed himself out from under the window, he managed to break the glass. He tried to squeeze through the bar again, managing just to get his head and arm outside the window before he became trapped. No matter how hard Reverend Larson tried, he could not move. He screamed, "Oh, God, no," as the flames overtook his body. An air conditioning unit fell from the third-story window, hitting him on the head. It would take hours before the officials would remove his charred body from the window.
Oh, my God. That's awful.
The first fire truck got there within 2 minutes of the emergency call. The other three were there 2 minutes after that. Most everyone that would survive the fire was out by the time the trucks arrived. Now, this had never been confirmed, so it's just hearsay. But one man that had escaped the bar fire said as he was coming out, he overheard the conversation by two of the firemen. The first fireman said, "We can't get up there." And the other replied, "Oh, fuck it. It's only faggots. Let them burn." This was mentioned in the book Let the Faggots Burn by Johnny Townsend. The author interviewed as many of the survivors as he could, and it honestly, reading this book really brought the tragedy to life and even more heart-wrenching than it already is. Johnny Townsend never did name the man who said it, so I can't say if it's correct or not, or if it even happened. All the survivors watched from the street in horror as they saw their friends in the windows, frantically trying to escape the inferno. They were being burned alive before their eyes. As the firemen used the fire hose to jet the water through the window, Buddy was able to clearly see Adam screaming as the flames overtook his entire body. He had been too afraid to leave the bar stool. He had just froze in place. A bartender from another bar was on his way to work. His name was Milton Mary. He remembers, quote, "After all those screams and yells for help, everything got quiet. All you could hear were the firemen shouting orders. It was very eerie. It just went from a cacophony of noise to very quiet. And I realized that all of those people stacked like cords of wood against those windows were dead." The flames were completely put out by 8:12. From the time the fire was first spotted until the flames were completely extinguished, 29 people died in 19 panic-filled minutes. The crowd had started to grow. Police arrived on the scene. Priests in the area came and gave prayers of conditional absolution for the dead. Survivors tried comforting each other. Some started to help load up the wounded into ambulances. Everyone had a hard time not looking up at the grisly scene of the burned bodies in the window. One newspaper photographer called to the scene didn't know about the fire happening at a bar. He only knew that he was there to photograph the fire. When he arrived, he looked at what he thought was a mannequin factory and commented to the other photographer about how things could have been worse. At least the only things that were damaged were mannequins. Ugh. To which the other photographer said, "Those aren't mannequins." Reporters were trying to talk to survivors. Some talked to the press, only if their names wouldn't be mentioned, and some even spoke with their backs to the camera, out of fear of being outed or fired from their jobs. Reporters were trying to talk to survivors. Some talked to the press, only if their names wouldn't be mentioned, and some even spoke with their backs to the camera, out of fear of being outed and fired from their jobs. Rusty Quinton spoke to a lot of journalists about his escape from the fire. He also spoke of what it was like to watch people being burned alive. Quote, "I knew almost everyone in that bar. They were my friends." One spectator was quoted as saying, "We watched those people burn before our very eyes, and we couldn't do a thing to help them." Major Henry M. Morris from the New Orleans Police Department made a statement about how identifying the people would be difficult due to the fact that most may have false IDs. Adding, quote, "Some thieves hung out there, and you know, this is a queer bar." And back then, queer was derogatory.
Totally. Me being naive, I thought it meant that they were younger and they had fake IDs to get into a bar.
And that's false, too. I mean, they didn't have fake IDs. They might have changed their names a little bit. Like, Richard Cross only was known as Mother at the bar, right? Mm-hmm. They had nicknames. Yeah. But the only ones that had fake IDs were usually teenagers.
Right.
When Buddy caught sight of the dark-haired man he threw out of the bar, he grabbed him by the arm and dragged him to a police officer, demanding that he be questioned. Buddy knew it was arson. Buddy, being an ex-fire chief, he suspected Roger was the one responsible for arson.
Really?
The police? Mm-hmm. Police didn't seem interested. They pretty much ignored him. They were more interested in the crowd control. Most of the injured, about 15 people, went to Charity Hospital. A new state-of-the-art burn unit was supposed to open in a few weeks, but they had to open it that night. Luckily, most that went to the hospital survived and had to undergo months of painful skin grafts and therapy. three of the most seriously burned would later pass away. And, you know, in the documentary, they spoke about how seeing this on the news and everything on the Sunday night, how they all weren't out at work because they couldn't be. They had to go to work the next day and pretend like everything was okay and pretend that they hadn't even heard of the bar and pretend that they didn't lose all their friends.
Wow. Yeah.
Could you imagine?
No. No, that's awful.
The city's emergency personnel were later criticized for leaving the bodies in the window where people can see them for such a long period of time. Were they insensitive or were they just homophobic? But the reality was that they couldn't even get into the bar until 90 minutes after the fire was put out. The fire had burned at such an intense heat that the room needed to cool before it was safe to enter. There was also the sickening smell of burnt flesh, which caused firemen to take little breaks to regain their composure. Then, dealing with the bodies was a process within itself. There were 17 corpses alone stacked at the corner of the window, and they were all intertwined. The coroner's assistants had to untangle the bodies two at a time, and they had to decide which pieces went where. Photographs then had to be taken, and then they were placed in the bags with any identifying objects like keys, wallets, or jewelry. They did find some bodies by the bar, some were under the piano, and some were in the bathroom. And then while searching the scene, investigators came across a 7-ounce can of lighter fluid at the bottom of the stairwell where the fire had started. Reverend Troy Perry, founder of the MCC, was notified of the fire. Other members of the MCC and other gay advocate group leaders headed to New Orleans to help with the press and to set up a memorial for the dead. When one of the men arrived in the New Orleans airport, he mentioned to a man that he was in town because of the tragedy. The man laughed and said, quote, "What tragedy? I don't know of any tragedy. Only some faggots got burned." That wasn't the last time derogatory things were said. Many horrible jokes were made, such as, question, "What major tragedy happened in New Orleans on June 24th? Answer, "Only 30 faggots died, not more." The joke that would live in infamy was made by a New Orleans radio host. He said that the best way to dispose of 30 gay men was to, quote, "bury them in fruit jars."
I don't even know what that means.
Well, there were so many people. You know, a fruit jar, gays were called fruit.
I know.
Fruits.
But
they were burned to a crisp. There were ashes.
Stupid. Idiot.
The first stop Reverend Perry and his associates made was to the bar to leave yellow chrysanthemums. And I'll tell you, it was interesting. And all throughout the book, they kept saying yellow chrysanthemums. The flowers were yellow chrysanthemums. I looked that meaning up. It signifies neglected love or sorrow. So Reverend Perry and his associates left yellow chrysanthemums at the door of the upstairs, and over the next few days, hundreds of flowers were left at the entrance. His next stop would be holding a press conference. There, they criticized city officials for not making a statement about the fires and the deaths of 29 men. The governor of Louisiana and the mayor of New Orleans had and would remain silent. Even though they would be repeatedly asked to make statements, they never really acknowledged the fire or the loss of lives.
How could they not? Seriously, if like you just lost almost 30 people in a fire and you're not going to say anything?
I know.
And it's arson?
It's political, meaning they were too scared to
say
anything.
I'm sorry. People died. People are people. They died. Mm-hmm. Jeez, come on.
Reverend Perry also criticized the police for their statements they made to the press. Then they announced their plans for a memorial service that evening. Reverend Perry at first had problems finding a church to hold the memorial service. Some of the churches he called were rude to him. They laughed at him. Some even hung up on him. Thankfully, Reverend Bill Richardson of the St. George Episcopal Church came through for the MCC once again. Not many people attended the service. Many people either hadn't heard about it, many people were still in shock, and others didn't really know who to mourn because the dead had not been identified yet. But there was probably around 30 people that attended.
That's it?
Reverend Perry, well, they were afraid. They didn't want to come out to be outed.
You still be friends with
Or they
somebody.
Were too in shock. Yeah. It was a different time. Little sidetrack here, Joan Gosnell, she was straight. She survived. She was in the hospital and she had skin grafts. And later she lost friends because they automatically assumed she was gay and lesbian. She even, while she was in the hospital getting skin grafts, they fired her and replaced her with somebody else.
Of course they did.
Mm-hmm. Her job. Yeah. Mm. Reverend Perry started the service, quote, "Somebody said that the fire killed just a bunch of faggots, but we knew them as people, as brothers and sisters, and we will never forget them." He also asked for prayers for the arsonists because they have to live with themselves. The next day, Reverend Richardson received the call from the bishop of the Louisiana Episcopalian Church. The bishop was very angry about the service being held, and the reverend was upset and wanted to resign. He sat down and wrote a letter to his congregation, and he stated, "St. George is not a private club, but a house of God." And he explained why allowing the service to be held to the church was a good thing. Quote, "Would Jesus have barred these grief-stricken people from his church? If any member still feel that our church is to minister only to the select few and not to the whole community, then I shall seriously consider resigning as your rector." He did not have to resign. Thank the Lord.
Good.
Now, Archbishop Philip Hannon of the Catholic Church never once made a public statement about the fire in the upstairs lounge. He never offered prayers for the dead. He never offered comfort or support for the victims' families or friends. Not one comment about the deadliest fire in New Orleans history. However, he did instruct his clergy not to give any Catholic funeral services to any of the victims, nor would he allow them burial in Catholic cemeteries. Archbishop Hannon died in 2011. He never did speak about why he wouldn't allow Catholic burials for the victims, even when he was given a chance to explain himself. Identifying the bodies was the biggest obstacle, but not because people were carrying false IDs like the chief of police stated. Many of the bodies had been burned so severely that they were unrecognizable. Some bodies were seared to the floor. Fingerprints weren't able to be used when the finger pads or the fingers itself were totally gone. And the wallets were burned so badly that the IDs were gone. However, they did identify Reggie Adams by the ring Regina gave him. He was buried with it because it melted into his finger.
Oh, that's awful, but that makes me happy. You know.
I understand. Police asked anyone that knew anyone in the fire to call them so they could obtain dental records. One of the victims had been a dentist. Dr. Perry Waters was a member of the MCC, and he was single. And the day after the fire, when he didn't come into work, his secretary called the police. He was identified by his dental records. And then, since Dr. Waters had many of the bar's patrons as patients, more victims were able to be identified. The secretary handed over dental records. Three men were never identified, so they could never be claimed. And one man, Ferris LeBlanc, was identified but never claimed. The MCC tried to give these men a decent burial, but the law stated bodies could only be released to family, so they had no legal way to claim the bodies. These four men were buried in unmarked paupers' graves. Those graves and the locations have since been lost once Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in 2005. They can't find any of the bodies. And then, to make matters worse, in 2015, Ferris LeBlanc's nephew did a simple Google search on his uncle's name. The family had always wondered what had happened. He had just kind of disappeared. They had no idea he was in the fire, much less dead. They were never contacted. They couldn't find the body. That's when they found out that everybody that was buried in those paupers' fields, their location has been lost. They can't find the bodies. Insult to injury, you know?
I can't even fathom that today. Well, for anybody you love, I don't understand that. Or not even love, any human, you know? Mm-hmm.
Reverend Bill Larson's mother wouldn't claim his body. She was too embarrassed by his sexuality. But she did give permission for him to be released to the MCC for cremation. His ashes are in a family tomb donated by an MCC member. But however, that tomb does not bear his name. Reverend Perry called for a second memorial on July 1st. This time he encouraged the gay communities across the nation to hold a memorial for the victims also. And once again, there were problems finding a church. Finally, Edward Kennedy, the Black Reverend of St. Mark's United Methodist Church, allowed the memorial to be held inside his church. The media were notified of the plans, and 3,000 flyers were printed to advertise the National Day of Mourning, quote, in memory of the New Orleans fire victims. The flyers were handed out on the street, and many folks were afraid to take them for fear that they would be outed just by taking a flyer. To the surprise of Reverend Perry, many businesses in the area hung up the flyers, including those businesses run by straight individuals.
Good.
It's estimated that 250 people attended this memorial, and at the time, that was the largest public gathering for a gay cause in the city's history. Many patrons of the upstairs lounge attended. Bishop Finnis Crutchfield of the United Methodist Church of Louisiana came to the memorial just not to show his support. But, as he told Reverend Perry, quote, by my presence, I want every Methodist to know Reverend Kennedy is not a renegade pastor acting without permission.
You mean he's a compassionate person?
And he follows the word of the Bible. He follows Christ's teaching, yes. It's very nice.
It's, you know, shocking. Almost as if they should. Huh. Mm-hmm.
The fire marshal seemed to be investigating the fire more than the police. And honestly, the police kind of really did screw the pooch on this. Arson was suspected from the start, but there was no motive. Reverend Perry had already suspected arson since two of his churches had been set on fire.
How is that not a motive? It's a hate crime. That's such a motive. You don't even have to know them.
That
was 1970.
That wasn't even thought of back then, though.
Come on, though. Of course it is. Look at the harassment that gay people have had to deal with over the centuries. I mean, come on. Like, of course that's the reason.
Buddy had always suspected Roger Nunez of setting the fire. He even gave a statement saying as much, but he didn't really know the guy's name. At the time, they only knew him as the dark-haired guy. When questioning people in the area, they spoke with a clerk at Walgreens. She remembered a dark-haired man that came in to buy some lighter fluid. In the police report, she said, quote, he appeared to be gay because he was soft-spoken, and the way he carried himself, and he had feminish traits. He seemed upset.
I'm laughing that she's like, he seems to be gay because he talks soft. Okay.
He seemed upset and drunk, and his hands were shaking. He wanted the 4-ounce tin of lighter fluid, but we only had in stock the 7-ounce can, so he bought that.
I'm just shocked. And I know, you know, 1970 was so long ago, but it was also so not that long ago. That
50 years ago.
Well, I know that. You don't have to point it out, because that's, you know, we already talked about that. Mm.
When the detectives found Roger, they thought he was intoxicated, but they were informed that he had actually just had an epileptic seizure. They took him to Charity Hospital, and it was discovered that Roger was also suffering from a broken jaw. That's because he was punched, right?
Mm-hmm.
Roger needed surgery and would have to stay in the hospital for a while, and it was agreed that the hospital would keep the police updated on Roger and let them know when he was released. Now, mind you, this is a suspect for arson. Did they put a guard outside his room?
They did not.
They did not.
Not even arson. 28 people murdered. 28
exactly.
People dead.
Mm-hmm. Murdered. On July 7th, the officers went back to the hospital to check on Roger, only to find out that he had been released earlier the previous day. The police claimed that they were never called, but later the fire marshals would find evidence that that was not true. The police officers supposedly tried searching for Roger, but reports of the following days showed that they might not have been looking too hard. On July 15th, the New Orleans Fire Department's chief, McCrossin, made an announcement that the fire in the upstairs lounge was officially arson. July 17th, the police once again got a call from the fire marshal's office telling them they needed to speak to Michael Scarborough. Michael had been transferred to a hospital about 90 minutes away. Although he corroborated the stories of all the others at the bar that night, he did add a new fact. Michael told the police how he had heard this man say, "I'm going to burn you all out." Police brought pictures to see if Michael could identify the man he punched. And sure enough, Michael picked out the photo of Roger Nunez. And now, it seems here that the police have the culprit, right? Man hits suspect, suspect mm-hmm. gets mad, threatens to burn down bar, goes out to buy lighter fluid, bar burns mm-hmm. down. Bingo, we got him. Book yeah. him, Dano, right?
Right.
6 weeks after the police spoke with Michael, they closed the case. The report states they claim that Roger Nunez, quote, could not be located for interview and described the fire as being, quote, undetermined origin. And the witness's testimony was, quote, conflicting in content.
Stop it. Really?
I wish I was kidding.
Well, wow. Okay. Well, we know why that happened. Let's be honest. Well, let's put it out there right now.
I'm going to talk to you about it right now.
Okay, good.
Many of the gay community in New Orleans assumed that the police were never really interested in solving the crime and didn't want to be investigating the possible murder of people they viewed as unworthy of their time. Mm-hmm. The Upstairs Lounge arson author, Clayton Delery Edwards, points out that the police reports were littered with things like, quote, "He frequented homosexual bars and usually lived with homosexuals," and "he was living with a homosexual," and then writing about the MCC as the congregation that most of these homosexuals belong to, instead of saying words like "he frequented the bars and he lived with mm-hmm. such and such." Yeah.
They were trying to frame it in the narrative that they wanted. I get it.
The labels didn't matter, but they used them. And he states in the book that he feels, quote, "case reports exposes a certain unease with or distaste for the people with whom the investigation brought them into contact." The documentary that I watched, Clayton Delery Edwards is in there, and I want to be his best friend. He's like very smart. He's very well-spoken.
Well, I like his name. And, I'll tell you that right now. I'm one of three names.
Southern. And he's an English teacher. What else could you love about that?
That's it. Sign me mm-hmm. up.
He knows that it's drag and not drug.
He probably does, for sure. Mm-hmm. And you know what? He would probably tell us that, but to the side. You know what I'm
exactly.
saying?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In 2013, one of the detectives did an interview with Time magazine. He said, quote, "There are a lot of times you'll know. You, as an investigator, will know what happened, and you know who did it. But legally, if you don't have any teeth to sink in to arrest someone, you'll just have to wait."
Yep.
"I'm sure in my heart of hearts, this is the guy who set our fire."
It is.
But he should have gone after him. That's all. They shouldn't have closed the case. They should have left it open.
But it has to be such a hard thing to do. You know what I mean? Like, to know somebody did something is way different than to be able to prove it. So I get that.
They should have kept it open. They knew it was arson. They shouldn't have closed it within 30 days.
If this happened today, it would be a whole different story. If those were 28 babies or 28 children or 28, you know, women in a women's shelter, it would be different. But they were gay, and that's all there is to that. It's 1970.
It's horrible.
It is horrible.
The police may have given up, but the fire marshals never did. In September, fire marshals were able to locate Roger Nunez and brought him in for questioning. After the first session, they decided to do a polygraph. But since Roger was prone to seizures, the lie detector would prove to be ineffective. They settled on the DECTOR, D-E-K-T-O-R, Psychological Stress Evaluation, or PSE. The PSE was designed to hear stress in vocal cords when the brain was forced to contradict a statement it knew to be false. And much like the polygraph, the results would not be admissible in court. According to the fire marshal's report, quote, "Mr. Nunez showed stress to pertinent questions about the case. Some of these questions were, did you set the fire at the upstairs lounge? And did you set fire in the stairway? 13 questions in, and Roger's attorney advised him to stop. Although they knew they had their suspect, they didn't have any evidence or a confession, and they had to let him go. In May of 1974, Roger married an older woman. She was 49 and he was 27.
What? Oh.
In fact, her name was Elaine, and just like many gay men in the area, they had a hard time accepting. They either wanted to fit in socially, or they had a hard time accepting who he really was. And from what was said, it seems like Roger had a hard time. He was raised in a religious background. You know, the people of the day actually believed being gay was a psychological disorder. So he was fighting demons with himself.
Hey, that's all fine and good. That, you know what? I feel for you. It's awful. However, you don't kill 28 people. I'm sorry.
Well,
there's a difference.
Just listen. Roger's seizures were happening more frequently, and soon Roger would be admitted into surgery to remove a tumor on the right frontal lobe in his brain. Elaine would later tell investigators that Roger told her he was gay after their wedding and that they had never had sex. And technically, they didn't even live together. She slept in the house, and Roger slept in a trailer out back.
How would you even get into that kind of a relationship? Wouldn't that come up earlier? Like, did they kiss before?
In the book, it was said that he kind of had financial problems, and he was maybe the brain tumor. He needed help. And
okay, but she was going to take him in?
She was support. I think she actually did love him, but
maybe she thought she could change him. Like that kind of scenario?
I have no idea.
All right. Oh, Elaine. Okay.
6 months after the couple were married, Elaine found Roger's body in the trailer. His death was ruled a suicide, death by pills and alcohol. The autopsy also revealed Roger had a skull-based tumor growing in his cerebral cortex, which is the lining of his brain. After Roger's death, a friend who dated Roger went to investigators and told them that sometimes Roger would get drunk and confess to setting the fire at the upstairs lounge. One time even, Roger admitted to buying the lighter fluid and starting the fire because he had been thrown out of the bar. But afterwards, when he was sober, he would deny it. Investigators asked this man why he didn't come forward with this information. And the man said, quote, "Possibly because I didn't believe that he had done it, and also because I still had feelings toward him." Some of the survivors believe that if Roger did set the fire, he wasn't aware of the consequences. Some of the survivors believe that if Roger really did set the fire, he wasn't aware of the consequences. It was just a stupid stunt that went horribly wrong. Another person Roger confessed to simply stated that all Roger said was he just wanted to scare the people at the bar.
I get that. He probably bought that little thing at Walgreens. I mean, obviously, this wasn't a well-thought-out crime, right?
Well, and he wanted the small
exactly.
tin,
and
but they didn't have
it. It was almost
tin.
Like, I'm going to show you, not right. knowing like what is going to mm-hmm. happen.
Unfortunately, the lighter fluid was on top of highly flammable carpet because, you know, the fire retardant pajamas that we used to get and the everything's fire retardant, that yeah. didn't happen until 1971,
yeah.
and the bar opened in 1970s. But with the lighter fluid, the flammable carpet, and then the dried out wooden stairs that was possibly like 150 years old or so,
yeah. Yep.
It just turned out to be more than Roger bargained for.
Not that I'm saying, but I'm just saying I get it. Not that it's okay, but I think that's probably what he did.
And who's to say if the tumor played a part in it?
Depending on where it is placed in the brain, depends on their
Well,
their
it was
behavior,
the front, but the frontal lobe, well, the different. Right frontal lobe. Wow. That was where the first tumor was. The other one was completely inside the lining of his brain. Reverend Perry says in the documentary Upstairs Inferno, quote, "We will never know for sure if Roger did it, but if he did, of course he is forgiven. And if he is the one that did it, he is the 33rd victim of the fire, and we have to remember that." The June 1973 arson of the upstairs lounge held the most unwanted title of deadliest attack on the gay community. That was until June 2016, when Omar Mateen opened fire on the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, killing 49 people and wounding 53 others. And after a three-hour standoff, officers with the Orlando Police Department shot and killed him. The police deemed this incident a terror attack. This is all I'm going to say for this story. there is so much more to this, but this is so long as it is. But I urge everyone to go watch the documentary Upstairs Inferno. It's on Amazon Prime, $3.99, cheapest you can get it. Also, go get the book Tinderbox, The Untold Story of the Upstairs Lounge Fire by Robert W. Fiesler, F-I-E-S-E-L-E-R, and The Upstairs Lounge Arson by Clayton Delery Edwards. And then also, the first book that was ever written on this subject was Let the Faggots Burn, The Upstairs Lounge Fire by Johnny Townsend. Each one is a great read. And another thing I did, I listened to the podcast Beyond Bourbon Street. It's episode 66. The books The Tinderbox and The Upstairs Lounge Arson totally go more into detail about the police records, about everything. And it goes into detail as some people think that this started the gay rights movement in New Orleans. Other people think it's about the Anita Bryant visit when she came there and said the famous quote, "I'd rather my kid be dead than be gay or homosexual," or whatever quote that was. I mean, the whole thing is just, I'm just blabbering right now, but
I'm reeling about the Anita Bryant comment. Really? Really?
Yeah, really. Yeah. But I really urge everybody to go take a look, and especially the least to do is the documentary. It's amazing. You get to see Regina is there, Ricky Everett, all the survivors are doing interviews. Oh. Reverend Troy Perry is on there. He's in tears half the time. I mean, it's really touching, and it's something.
It's amazing. So, well, you did a good job, and that was a lot to get through. I know that you were struggling because you bought all three books and watched the documentary.
And listened to the podcast. And I know. And I did go through some newspaper articles, but I tell you what, the Robert Fiesler, or I can't pronounce his name, but the author of The Tinderbox and The Upstairs Lounge Arson really did fantastic historical, they did it all. There was really no need to go and read all the Times-Picayune. And
I think that, like, you know, this was 1970, which seems so long ago, but again, that's not that long ago, considering. So I'm happy that we have made such strides, but not really. You know what I mean? Like, we've made a lot of strides since 1970.
Two steps forward, one step back.
Right. The AIDS epidemic hadn't hit.
That's another thing they go into. There was a big memorial fund set up that was kind of like a precursor to the AIDS funds. I mean, it's so interwoven, and it's...
Yeah.
I got lost in it.
Yeah.
And I cried a lot, and I got scared a lot. And the sash to one of our windows in my daughter's room is broken. And in the middle of the night, I woke up thinking, I need to call about getting the windows replaced. And it's...
No, I get you. It's terrible. Terrible. But that really was arson. That was murder. It was.
Shame on the police for not doing
more. It was a hate crime, but it was 1970. Terrible.
No, I think he probably hated himself more than he actually hated.
No, he was mad.
The gay community.
He was just a big old baby and went in there and was like, I'm going to show you. And he did that.
He was drunk. He had a brain tumor. Not to make excuses.
But he didn't realize that what's going to happen. Like, you think you...
No.
You know, like when...
And the fact that all the survivors forgive him for what happened is absolutely amazing.
Well, and I hate that he is not here anymore to say, you know.
I think he was tortured. He was a tortured man. I think he committed suicide because of it. I mean, I'm sure he knew that the brain tumor was there, or they didn't get all of it.
Do you know
that might have been the cause? But I think he
was in the area. Did he watch all that unfold? Do you know?
Yeah, actually, at one point he came around the building and he claimed that he had luckily just escaped, but nobody had ever seen him back in the bar.
Yeah. See, I'm wondering that. And to see that carnage and that scene, that would have to be burnt in your memory forever and ever. And that would...
No pun intended. No. But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the survivors, the people that stood on the street and watched their friends burn to death,
I can't even imagine.
That's horrifying.
Awful.
That's absolutely one of, like, awful. My biggest fears anyway, is to be burned to death. And it struck a chord with me. Let's put it that way.
Well, you did a good job, Jen.
And it's amazing how big of an incident this was. And really, no one came to know about this until 2016 after the Pulse nightclub.
Well,
that's when people really started to talk about it.
That's why it's so amazing that I said 1970 mm-hmm. was a long time ago, but yet not that long ago. And it really wasn't. Well, that's our lifetime, right? And this mm-hmm. happened, and people chose to forgive it. I mean, I do got to give kudos to people for coming a long way and accepting mm-hmm. all people, because we should, because we're all mm-hmm. in this together, really, let's be honest, right? And so, mm-hmm. but it's also...
Well, and I had never heard about this until we were at CrimeCon in New Orleans last mm-hmm. year, and we went walking in that freaking heat. I will never forget how hot it was.
Yeah, it was pretty freaking
and
awesome.
We kind of got lost a little bit, and we came across, there's a plaque that's right outside of Iberville, and there's a plaque dedicated to everybody that was lost mm-hmm. in the fire. And I had stopped, and I had said, did you know about this? And you're like, yeah, I think I watched the documentary on it. And I'm like, yeah, of course you did. But that was the first I had ever even known about it. Well, and I wanted to do this for Gay Pride, but we were off and just.
I got you, Jen.
That's it. I'm done.
Anyway, you did a great job. That's unbelievable. Seriously. Yeah. I just get so angry at people sometimes. Seriously.
I know. Like,
I'm not even going to say anything. Never mind. I was going to go on my tirade, but I won't. But anyway, Jen, good job. We're not going to keep people any longer. Stay tuned for, next week, another episode, blah, 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 blah. But until that time, Jen, remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
And bye-bye.
Love ya. Today's episode was researched and written by me, Jen. For more information about this episode, as well as all other sources, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by the hosts, Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all Our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. You can reach Nico at WeTalkOfDreams.com. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from Octoberpod VHS. You can find all of his great works on YouTube. Please make sure to like and subscribe to Our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter with the handle at Our True Crime Pod. You can also email us at OurTrueCrimePodcast@gmail.com. We would also at this time like to thank our patrons. We would be so lost without you. Thank you so much. And if you would like to help support the show, you can check us out on patreon.com/ourtruecrimepodcast. You can also show your support by leaving a 5-star review on Apple or simply just tell your friends about us. It's that easy. Love ya.
I'm singing the fancy song, Fancy by Reba McEntire.
Fancy.
Just thinking about her dancing okay. there. Jen, we were a year old. Bop, bop, bop.
Not even.
October.
Well, just started to be a year old.
We were a year old that month. Whoop, whoop.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. YMCA?
No.
In the Navy? In the Navy.
Nope. In the Navy. Ricky Mother Cross
requested it to play.
He requested the piano Dave play. No. He requested piano Dave play United We Stand by the Brotherhood of Man. Do you know that one?
I don't.
United we stand, divided we fall.
Nobody
and
liked
if
it.
Our backs are ever be against or and I'm sorry. Let me start that again because it's kind of poignant. It's kind of poignant. It's kind of poignant.
Yeah, that's I got saying. You.
And it goes, for united we stand, divided we fall. And if our backs were up, and if our backs are, and if our backs should ever be against the wall, we'll be together, you and I. In my crappy voice because my, you know.
You're not, you don't have a crappy voice. You made choir, Jen. It's okay.
Yeah, well. Mrs. Barrett said, what makes you think you're so special that you would make the better choir?
Well, at least you made one. I didn't. I was the only one. Yeah, well. Just saying.
Anyway, Nelly is kind of a slang word for effeminate gay men.
And Nelly's also a rapper from St. Louis. Nelly and the Lunatics.
I know. That's kind of interesting. Also the name of one of the characters in Valley of the Dolls.
Yes, it is.
But, Nelly. The casting was purely Shakespearean, meaning that they used men to play.
No, that was Neely. It was Neely. That was Neely.
Oh, that was right. It was Neely. Neely. So, yeah, you can take that out, Nico.
Sorry. I was like, that doesn't sound right. And then I had to think about it because Trent.
No, it wasn't because it was
Trent always called you Neely, remember?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry.
Sorry, Nico.
This is all bringing back memories. Okay, go ahead.
I know. And it became an important, very important, I'm telling you. It's important.
That made me laugh.
I'm important.
I'm important. Go on, get it. I'm important.
I'm important. Reggie was studying at Loyola University.
Crotch. I worked on crotch all week.
Loyola. Like Toyota.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah. So Reggie was studying at Loyola.
You got it. That was right.
No, I'm going to just do this. So Reggie. Reggie. Okay, you ready?
Yep.
I'm not even going to say it.
I know you but, know that's
what I'm laughing. I know. I don't know why this doesn't scroll for me.
I have to do it with my finger. Is that how you're doing it?
It won't even let me do it with my finger.
That's what
we all know you like.
She said. Oh, that's good stuff. Oh, middle school.
I got it.
Middle school.
Humor.
Never mind. Yeah, you know what I'm saying.
Come on, scroll down, fucker. So about around.
That's what she told him to do.
I know. About 7 on July 15th, New Orleans is hard for me to say for some reason.
NOLA.
Today.
Just say NOLA. NOLA.
This isn't NOLA. This is NOVD. NOVD. NOFD. New Orleans Fire Department.
Oh, NOFA. NOFA.
NOFD.
NOFA.
And although he corroborated, look at that. I got that on the first time, Camille.
Twice, technically. But yes. Okay, go ahead.
Let me scroll down there just a little bit. Just a little bit. Just the tip.
Just a little the tip. Bit. Just a little bit. Gonna make me wiggle it. Just, I don't know the words. I don't know the words.